Matthew, tell us a cool story, man.
Well, I remember my first day in population. They sent me in there. I'm 16 years old, scared to death, about to go to breakfast, about 6 o'clock in the morning. Still a little dark outside. I'm walking down this long walk. It's probably 100 yards walk to the kitchen. And I look to my left, and there's two guys sitting there, and they're slinging straight razors at each other. And, I mean, they're cutting each other up. And I was just thinking to myself, where the heck am I at? You know, because I'm going to breakfast. It's my first day.
I had just got there
at David
Wade. At David Wade?
In Homer, Louisiana. And first day in population, thinking, what's for breakfast? You know, what am I going to do today?
Pancakes on the mind.
Yes, I'm ready to go eat. And I see two guys just cutting each other up. I mean, really, blood everywhere. It's just didn't help my paranoia of entering into the prison facility.
So just off to the side, they were just getting after it. Like, you're just like walking in the hallway, then like you look off to the distance, there's just two guys just shirtless or what? What's happening?
No, they were dressed, you know, they were suited up. They were might have had some magazines wrapped around their arms and stuff, you know, trying to protect themselves.
They had a little phone book tuck.
Okay. They was planned. They were going to do this early in the morning. And the crazy thing was that everybody just walked right past them. Like, hey, that's no big deal. Let's go on. Let's go get breakfast. Next thing you know, here come all the guards running out there like a
stampede. Well, the motto is
mind your business. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Look the other way. Because if not, you become the target.
Yeah, so I just.
So at 16 year old, that was how that's how they oriented you. That was your orientation?
That was my first day in orientation. New intake, and I said, man, how am I going to do this the rest of my life, living like this?
Man, at 16, I know I wasn't, and I thought I was hard, too, at 16, but I was only hard around the age group and the people that I was with, right? But, like, I can't imagine going to an adult prison at 16, and that'd be my first interaction to the facility. I would probably have panicked.
Man. 16, our rowdy moments were fights at the Mormon church. 16, yeah. He's seeing people suited with phone books ready for freaking war.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Boxing matches in the front yard turned fist fight. Yeah. You know what I mean? Man, that's crazy. Welcome back, everybody. This is the first episode in season 2. The left of me, I've got your best friend in real estate.
All your real estate needs right here.
Bout it, Beatty. And in front of us, we got Mr. Matthew Pineda, right? Is that how you say it?
Pineda.
Man, Mr. Pineda has a cool story, and I won't tell it for him, so I'll let him roll into it, but we appreciate you coming. And I just found out he and I are both from the East Bank, right?
That's right.
Metairie. And Kennebra.
Kenna City.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, man. Where are you from? What your childhood was like, and kind of the segue to the institution, man.
Okay, grew up, born in Metairie, lived there a few years. My dad was playground supervisor at Mike Molly Playground back then. Back then it was Airline Park.
Mm-hmm.
You know, big part of the community and strong Catholic community. Ended up moving, I guess, when I was about 4 or 5 years old to Kenner. We're living in Driftwood. And
what Catholic church did you go to?
I went to St. Mary Magdalene.
Okay, I think we went to what's the one over there in Kenner, right by the levee?
Not St. Jerome.
No,
St. Jerome's about west.
Our Lady of Perpetual Help.
Okay, that's a little further away.
I went from being Catholic to Pentecostal like this. Overnight, my stepdad was Pentecostal, my mom was Catholic, and it was a strange twist. But anyways, go ahead. Fine. Sorry about that.
All right. Grew up most of my childhood in Kenner, playing sports all the time, played All-Stars, traveled all over. You know, my dad was always a coach or assistant coach. Ended up going to John Curtis Christian High School, played on 2 state championship football teams.
Okay.
You know, I got to move
around. Yeah, I thought you looked a little bit like linebacker or guard. What were you?
I was outside linebacker.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Played all-star basketball. You traveled to Puerto Rico for 2 international bitty tournaments and pre-prep tournaments. So I was, you know, well-seasoned, moving around, traveling, and having a lot of unique experiences as, you know, a young kid. very fortunate, very privileged. My mom and dad worked real hard, you know, to provide for four kids, putting them all through private schools. We weren't rich, but
You played all the sports.
We played all the sports, and so did my brothers.
Hell,
and my
sister. It's almost rich families today. Yeah, are, they spend all their money on tournament ball.
If you're if you're a two sport athlete or more, that's basically like having horses in the South.
I was playing everything all year long, so I was just going from one game to another. And that's pretty much how it was. My mom and dad were always there at all the games, so I was very fortunate, very blessed, and you know, I ended up getting in with some wrong crowds. Everybody was kind of drinking and using some drugs, and I was always pretty straight-laced because, you know, my mom and dad
raised
me the right way, you know, a strong Catholic community, and just was always against it. And then I want to say about in 1985, started to use steroids, you know, trying to get a step up on everybody else.
Completely understandable.
Trying to get a starting job, you know, as a freshman, sophomore. And trying to beef up, get a little stronger, get a little faster, started doing that. And in December of 1985, my folks told me, you know, you need to think of who you want to live with because we're going to get separated.
I said,
man, I can't pick one over the other because I love my mom, you know, both the same. You know, there's no way I could pick one over the other. So I started just doing things that I would normally never pursue, and that was just smoking weed and doing a lot of drinking and staying out late. And usually they'd be waiting up for me at 11 o'clock. If I 1 minute past curfew, you know, they'd be right there to hammer me.
Bust you.
They didn't give me any attention after that, you know. I was just like, man, golly, things are really bad at home.
How old were you?
I was 15 at that time.
Okay.
And shortly after my 16th birthday, which was in December. Also, you know, I started just experimenting with another friend, using drugs, smoking weed, and didn't really know what it was laced with. Ended up getting one that was, you know, dipped in embalming fluid.
PCP? They call
them Flickums.
Whatever.
Yeah, and ended up breaking into a neighbor's house, you know, just thinking of what can I get to go and resell. Just pretty much just went in it and took over like it was my own. Mm-hmm. Didn't think anybody was home because there were no vehicles in the driveway. And ended up, they came home on me. I woke up while I was in their house in the middle of the night and ended up freaking out. Ended up stabbing them with a kitchen knife and ran out of there. And, you know, my family was leading the charge and, hey, we need to get this crime solved. And I'm hiding in the background, you know, wondering when they're going to come get
me. Oh, they didn't know it was you?
My folks did not know.
No, I'm saying, did the neighbors know?
No, nobody knew that it was me till like two weeks later they arrested me and decided they were going to try me as an adult, you know, despite your background, despite where you came from, despite, you know, the privileged family, and my parents were pillars of the community. They were going to make me an example. You know, you do the crime, you're going to serve the time. So they tried me as an adult at 16 years old. They gave me two life sentences and pretty much got rid of me and threw me away. And at that time, you know, I believed that I deserved that for what I had done, you know, because it was a terrible crime. Totally innocent victims, didn't deserve that. And just the worst day of my life, you know, I regret that I even started to use drugs, and that just led to some bad decisions, and breaking into that house was one of them.
Right. You know? Mm-hmm. You're talking about stabbing to death?
I stabbed two people.
Okay.
You know, out of just pure panic and fear and,
right,
you know, just thinking to myself, who's going to believe that I broke into a house? I can't let anybody know this.
Yeah.
You know, just freaking out. And, you know, they sent me away, and I lost everything, and had a promising future ahead of me because I was a good student, I was a good athlete, and I figured I would have gotten a college education with a scholarship in sports or academics even. You know, it was just had a lot of things going for me, and threw that away. Next thing you know, I'm sleeping next to, you know, guys on each side of me about 2 feet away. Got 75 people in the dorm using three or four shower heads together and three sinks. And
fighting
every day, you know, I got to worry about people hitting me in the back of the head, stealing all my property. And it was just, you know, a lifestyle that I just did not know even existed, and didn't really care, you know, prior to me going to prison.
Nobody, yeah, I was telling you, nobody grows up and is like, you know what, I think I'm going
to try it out real
quick. Try it out. It's like you just all of a sudden you're jolted from society, and here you are.
Yeah.
So whenever you were hiding, you were like just doing everything business as usual, going breakfast, lunch, dinner, sports, and then what happened? How did, how did it catch up to you?
Well, I was ended up being in a parade with one of my girlfriends, and I had to get throws. And so I ended up using the credit cards that I snatched off of the countertop when I was running out of the house.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and bought throws, and that pretty much traced them back to me because the lady that ran the Mardi Gras store, her sister was a bus driver at my school.
Mm-hmm.
Go figure, small world. But, you know, it was just I guess fate, you know, for me to go. And, you know, I was scared to death. Didn't have to shave yet. You know, cute little kid going in here, and I got nothing but a bunch of hardened convicts, you know, staring at me, trying to intimidate me, you know, and just.
I always hated it for the young guys, especially the young guys that looked innocent when they came in. You know, you see a. I saw a good number of 18, 19-year-old boys coming through, and I can always peg which ones were going to get harassed. And, you know, dude number one and dude number two in the dorm was going to try, go with the move, send the dude. And I always would try to put them underneath my wing. And I just it's an environment that if you're not growing up, if you're not raised in an environment where you're taught to be tough, you either have to learn quick, or you're screwed.
Or you get taken by the tide.
Yeah,
yeah.
It was pretty scary.
So they put you in the grown ass men section, 16, and then now it's like you and probably like a few. It's like early like NBA draft. Like it's like you and like Kobe, Kevin Garnett, then a bunch of freaking like 30-year-old men out there just playing around. But instead of basketball, it's
get to work. You know, yeah. Get your cut.
Yeah. So you was out in the field.
I was out in the field for, you know, a few years.
So tell everybody just real quick, whenever they say catch a cut, catch a line, what does all that mean if you want to explain that to everybody?
Well, they give you this garden hoe, you know, as dull as it can be, and they tell you lay it down on the ground, and that's your cut. You know, as wide as that hoe is, that's what you have to get cut, and you have to scrape the ground. They don't want to see any grass left. They just want to see dirt. They tell you turn it over, you know, I mean, flip the grass over so there's nothing but dirt showing, and just keep going. And if you can't keep up with the line, they're going to call the truck on you. They're going to come and put handcuffs on you, take you to the cell block, and take all your privileges away, and you'll do 24 hours a day in a cell.
Did you ever see anything crazy in the field, like dudes getting shot at or anything? We've had guys on here, the stories where they get hosed across the head and stuff. Did you see any crazy stuff?
I did see one crazy story. There was a fella, he was Cuban, and there was another guy, he was an African American. He kept making fun of how he talked, you know, like, Migo, Migo.
Yeah.
And Migo kept telling him, hey, leave me alone, leave me alone.
Things are ticking time bombs too, boy.
Like, you know, F it with me, you know, F it with me. Uh-huh. And guy kept picking on him. And when he turned his back, that Cuban turned around and sunk that hoe right in his head. Boom.
I wonder if that's the same.
Where was that at?
That was at David
Wade. No, it's not the same store.
So many.
I think a lot of guys have gotten.
That's kind of probably like a common thing.
It was horrifying. I mean, it was blood everywhere, and the Cuban guy, he was stud on the back of his neck and pulled that hoe out. He was going to hit him again.
Guard stopped.
And the guard shot at his feet and said, "The next one is not going to miss. I promise you. Put the tool down." So he threw it down. Next thing you know, everybody that's on the line. Because the guards weren't going to do anything. They didn't want to touch anybody with blood. You know, no. AIDS was all over the place at that time.
Yeah.
So they weren't going to touch any blood. So everybody in the line, the regular inmates, we're all just taking off our shirts and sweatshirts trying to compress.
This dude's knocked out, bleeding, or like making noises.
Did he make it?
He survived. And you know what? He was still loudmouth picking on people after that. It didn't change him one bit. He was still ignorant.
Jeez.
That was a pretty horrifying one.
Wow. So, you 16 years old, You get sentenced to two life sentences.
What's it like whenever they told you, like, I guess the...
Verdict.
Verdict, yes, thank you. Like, what was it that went through your mind, like, whenever you heard the words?
I just broke down crying like a little kid.
You were a 16 kid. 16
year old, yeah.
I mean, I was 16 years old, like, you know, like a little baby.
Rightfully
young, like
so.
A little young baby. And I was like, man, my life is over. You know, and I was thinking about my parents and my family most of all, you know, because they had to endure a lot just because of what I did. You know, especially after everybody found out it was me. You know, had people writing graffiti on their house. You know, my little brother had to change schools because they were giving him a hard time at the school. They just totally changed churches. And then eventually ended up picking up, moving out of Kenner and moved across the lake.
St. Tammany?
In St. Tammany.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, did you have a girlfriend when you went in?
I did have a girlfriend. And
how long did she stick around?
It was about a year, I guess. You know, and I
pretty Dude, much, that's strong.
It was. And I pretty much pushed them all away. You know, like, hey, y'all have go live your life. You know, don't waste it on me because I'm going to be here for a while. You know, for the rest of my life. Even at that time, I was still believing something's going to happen for me.
Mm-hmm.
Something's going to happen for me. One day that a law will change or something's going to happen, I'll have an opportunity for release. And that you had to hold on to some kind of hope because there was no hope in places where we were going. And that was just it. You know, my family raised me in a strong Catholic family and spiritual background. So all the things that I learned of when I was a kid, you know, kind of came back to mm-hmm. me, and I just started remembering, you know, treat people right, be respectful of people, mind your business, you know, help those who were less fortunate. And so I did those things, and I started just making a difference in everywhere I went inside the prison facility and just kind of building community because I'm trying to make my life better as well on the inside.
Yeah.
I don't want people fighting around,
comfortable,
stabbed, you know. So we built a little community. People were sharing, you know, people helping each other out, trying to do things to help other people, little community service projects with some of the inmate organizations, had people coming in from the outside. They were liking what we were doing. So they started.
Were you a Toastmaster?
I was a Toastmaster. I was a JC.
That's the B word.
You were doing both?
I was doing
Dang,
both.
Yeah, man. It's like being a Crip and a Blood.
That's like Marvel versus DC. You don't mix that.
It's like. And I was like, why not? Why not? Just because you say it's so. And in prison, you know, if you're friends with one guy and they have a problem with somebody else, like, you can't be friends with both of them.
Yeah.
I was like, why not? That's stupid to me. Why can't I be friends with
So everybody? You had the personality, though, that you can just click with. That was how it was. I mean, I didn't have many enemies in prison. I can kind of interchange it. Like, you know, I'm a Christian, but I some of my best friends when I was in prison were Muslims.
Yeah, still kicking it with the Muslim.
V-Fat's a Muslim. Sherm's Muslim.
Shout out Black Russians.
You know what I mean? So you got if you're a people person, man, you just get along with everybody. You treat everybody with respect. Don't matter what they do. You ain't got to believe what they believe, but I mean, you still got to treat them like a human and be friends.
Man, a lot of my friends were heathens.
Yeah,
you know, a lot of my best friends were heathens. And everybody was asking me, like, why do you mess with that guy? You know, he's into drugs, and another one's in this, and he's into that, illegal activities. And I was like, well, why can't I be their friends? You know, who's going to reach them if I don't even try?
You know who had that attitude? Jesus.
Yeah.
So it was pretty good. I'm not comparing myself to Jesus.
Well, I think
that
was pretty clear.
It did go a long way.
I see you, Jesus.
It did go a long way. I had some guys come to me, and he was – you know, devout atheist.
Oh, yeah.
You know, self-proclaimed atheist. And it's like, hey, man, he said, how do you do it? You have two life sentences. You walk around here smiling, you're enjoying yourself, and you're in all these programs, and you're never going home. Why are you doing that? I said, well, this is my life. You know, I'm not serving life. I'm living life.
Mm.
You know, this is my life. If this is where it is, this is what I'm going to be. You know, be the person that I was going to be anyway.
Yep.
And so he was like, hey, how do I get what you have? So then I can witness to him. You know, that was a door open right mm-hmm. there. I could share with him. And then next thing you know, hey, they're coming to church. Next thing you know, they're getting involved in inmate organizations. Next thing you know, they're getting in vocational trades. And like, okay, my life's going
to
be
You got to introduce them guys to something new, man. Do you know Chris Pendleton? I mean, Christopher Pendleton?
I don't think so.
Chris Penn? He's at Rayburn. I was just having that talk with him the other day on JPay. I was saying that those guys in there and the peace that they have, I think anybody who's come home and has been out of prison for a long time, when you think back, there's a lot of things that you'd like, I don't want to go back to there. I do miss the peace that I had. Mm-hmm. I was at my spiritually highest when I was there. And I would say, I don't ever want to have to go back to get there. But, like, I think that guys who do time in prison take for granted that serenity that you're able to get in there. Mm-hmm. And the hard part is maintaining it when you come home, because life hits you in the face just like that.
Yeah.
Quick. And it's like, I always strive to be back in that place mentally, spiritually, even physically. I look like a Greek statue when I come home. Now I'm like doughboy type stuff. Yeah. But, you know, like I was at peace. I didn't like where I was at. I knew I wanted to get out. I knew I never wanted to go back. But the peace that I had, I wish I could have that again today. I can. I just have to get there. But I miss that. I really do. Do you feel that way?
I don't miss the place. I miss my friends.
The peace.
You know, there was so many guys that I had four or five meetings a week, you know, and most of them I either facilitated or I was the leader of it, president of the club or whatever it was, Bible study, discipleship classes, Kairos, Catholic RCIA services. I was leading them all, and that was, I guess that's what kept me going, kept mm-hmm. me motivated, mm-hmm. kept me hopeful. And then seeing all these guys getting out and they're making their lives better by what they experienced in prison, and to think, you know, hey, this is really good, Lord, you know, I'm going to keep doing this. But it sure would be nice if I had my chance one day, you know, and I talked to God just like I talked to you guys. And, you know, he really opened doors up for me. And I think probably the most amazing thing that he did for me, you know, I think it was a manifestation, you know, that he created that I was going up for parole eligibility. Jefferson Parish didn't want to give it to me after a U.S. Supreme Court ruling said that they have to give juvenile sentence to life an opportunity for release. And the state reserved the right to resentence some of them to life without parole again if they were the most incorrigible and non-rehabilitative individuals. And so they tried to say that, you know, I was the worst of the worst. And I had to fight them for 2 years to get parole eligibility after that. And, you know, while we were going through all these old court papers and documents, we discovered that my victims had two daughters that were living in Missouri. One was 69 and the other one was 72. And we didn't even know they existed. And so when we found that out, our legal team contacted them and said, hey, Matthew's been wanting to, we didn't know y'all existed for all this time, but Matthew wants to speak to y'all and, you know, just apologize to y'all face to face. Let him tell you his side of the story, not just what you heard through the DA's office and the media. And so when they got that notice from my legal team, they said, we've been praying for him for 35 years.
So 35 years is where you're at now in this story?
Okay. Yes. And so, you know, we set up a meeting. And they flew all the way down from Missouri to come and sit with me. And the warden gave me his office for the day, one weekend. And he even brought food in for us to have together. And I cried most of the time, you know, snot coming out of my nose. And just threw myself at their feet mostly. And just said, you know, I'm so sorry for what I took away from your family. You know, I know I had to destroy your family and it was devastating. They said, stop. You don't even have to talk about it anymore. We've already forgiven you. And we wouldn't be here if we didn't know anything about you already. She said, because once we talked to your legal team, they showed us all the things that you've been involved in, showed us all the things that you've done with your life, and you didn't waste it. And they said, you know, we were kind of on a border on whether we would oppose or whether we would advocate on your behalf. But after we saw the things that you were doing, after meeting you, we want you to know we're going to advocate at your hearings. You've served enough time. And it's time for you to get out and have your own family if possible. I said, well, praise God. I don't understand such mercy.
Yeah.
I don't understand such
That's strong on them
such
to
forgiveness.
Yeah, to forgive.
It was amazing, you know, and I still can't believe it. But I do send them photos. I send them texts, you know, holidays, send them cards. And just truly beautiful women. It was just, that was one thing that I prayed for more than anything. You know, that was, to me, that was more valuable than being free.
Right.
Physically. You know, having that opportunity to talk to them. And, you know, I'm just so grateful to be free, you know, because everybody was telling me I was going to die in prison. And I believed them to an extent. But I held on to that hope that one day I might get out. And God allowed me to get out. My parents are both still living. And, you know, I spend as much time as I can with them. They're both so old, you know, they can't really keep up their own house. So I go there and I tell my mom, hey, make your honey-do list because I'm coming. I'm bringing my tools. You know, I'm bringing my energy drinks. And, you know, if I got to wash gutters and clean the roof and I'm going this weekend, I'm going resurface their cool deck around their back patio. I've got a swimming pool. And
if they ever need a new roof, you got a friend indeed.
You got it.
Yeah. You told me a story, and I want you to share it here though. Tell everybody about how you got into vocational classes. So they kept denying. So, and then finally they're like, all right, this kid's aggravating. Let me go ahead and let him know. So yeah. What happened?
I was 17 years old. You know, just got in. When I first got there, they give you a little placement test, and so I was able to take my GED test and got it first test. Ended up getting the highest score ever at the prison. You know, it was like the valedictorian, but I didn't think it was anything special.
Was it the TAPE test?
No, it was the actual GED test. Okay, highest score ever received there. And
did they put your frame on the wall?
They put me up on the wall.
Did they really?
The highest score, you know, ever. So it was pretty cool. To me, it was like me and the gold medalist in the Special Olympics. You know, it was like y'all making this out of something special. But, you know, it's just the prison GED is what I was thinking. But, you know, I said, well, now that I got this, can I get in VOTEC? I want to take up welding, get me some trades, and do whatever I can do to improve my situation, you know, and prepare myself for one day when I will get out of here.
This was before having the conversation with the two daughters.
This was like 30 years, 30-something years before.
Okay.
This was right at the beginning. And, you know, I was still young. Little pretty boy in prison trying to be a preppy, and you know there's no preps in prison. Just doesn't
the best
fly.
You can do is have some starched down state jeans and some fresh pair of Brogans.
It's blue chamois.
And hopefully you got a plug in the laundry room that can bleach and spot your pants so you can dress swagged out at the visiting ship, get you some fresh numbers down the side and stuff.
Here I am trying to ask the education director, hey, give me a chance, you know, let me get a trade. And they're like, so no, we're not going to waste any resources on you because you have life sentence. You're never going home. Why should we spend the money on you to learn something that you're never going to be able to use on the outside? So I'd bug them. I was sending them a letter every other week, you know, and just asking, hey, let me get in school. Let me get into vocation. Anyone, I don't care. Industrial maintenance, carpentry, welding, auto mechanics. And they were like, no. And finally, they called me up to the office and said, hey, stop writing letters. Leave us alone. You know, you're not getting in. I said, well, you know, at least put me on a waiting list. And they said, okay, we'll put you on a waiting list, you know, if that'll satisfy you. But, you know, as far as anybody's on the list that has a number of years in their sentence, they're going to go before you. I'm like, great, so there's a chance. So 2 years later, after bugging them every other week, you know, and saying, hey, am I ready to go in yet? Is my name on a list? You know, going from 30, 40 people on the list down to about five. You know, they had two openings come up in welding. I said, oh, this is my shot. So I knew everybody that was on the waiting list and keeping tabs on them, see where they are so I can get in school. Well, one of them ended up transferring. One of them went to work release.
See ya.
Halfway house. One of them went to lockdown. So they had two openings left. They still had two guys on the list, and that was then me. And luckily for me, one of the guys got wrote up, and he got a disciplinary report. So if you get a disciplinary report, you got to wait 90 days before you're eligible to get into school. So he got a write-up, was found guilty. That left one person on the list, and me. Mm-hmm. So I went to the education director. I said, Miss Kim, I'm ready to get in VOTEC now. She's like, no, Matthew, there's five people on the list ahead of you. I said, no, ma'am. One transferred, one actually went home, one's at work release, and one just got a write-up and was found guilty, so he's not eligible. So they got one guy on the list and me. Can I get in? And they're like, yes, Matthew, you can finally get in. She says, golly, how long's it been? I said, 2 years. I've been waiting patiently 2 years to get in school. Once I got in school, they got to know me. They got to liking me. That once I finished my welding course, they wanted me to tutor. So I started tutoring guys, got pretty good at it, ended up becoming a welder fabricator there, building everything that they needed all of.
Yeah, all the guards parish. That hunt, duck hunt and fish, you were building boats and stuff, weren't you?
I had tree stands. Deer stands I was building.
You were doing metal lock-ons?
I was doing
Or you were building wood stands?
No, I was doing
metal.
I was making them
like the lock-ons,
like yeah.
Bow stands,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Like conduit and angle iron. Mm-hmm. The lighter, the better. Yeah, because they got
to
carry them
out there. We used to. I was in the welding program at Rayburn, and we were building boats, and I did a few lock-ons and stuff like that. I actually wish I could find one of the ones that, because I hunt all the time. Mm-hmm. I want one of the ones that I made. I'll never be able to find it. But I wish I could have got my stands back.
Well, whenever y'all are making it, there's not like a serial number or anything like that on it?
No.
The guards there that oversee the vocab, I'm sure it's the same thing that David, but like they use you to like, they'll sell all this stuff on the side and they'll buy the material and you're just the workhorse. And, you know, you take a guy like him, he's probably really good at welding, which is stick, MIG. But
I did it all. I did aluminum. Yeah. I did MIG, TIG.
So, I mean, he could probably do anything. He'd been in there years. They're like, hey, Sergeant Tanner, he needs a 15-foot aluminum. You can go ahead and do that and then fab it up. Got you the grinder and do. Got a new boat, man. Hey, yeah. He's coming to pick it up next week. Thank you. Appreciate it.
It was good funny job. Because they wouldn't make me a trustee because I had life sentence and I was still young. They said, well, you're not 40 years old yet. We're not going to take a chance on you. You might run. But they needed somebody to do welding for them on the outside of the compound. So what they did, they put me in shackles on my feet and waist chains. And I'd have to walk out there, you know, to the job site. And then they'd take the handcuffs off of me so I could weld out there. And I didn't mind at all, you know. I was glad to get out. I was glad to do it. Gave me a little favor. Gave me a little privileges by doing that for them. And it opened up some doors for them, you know. Like, hey, if this is the way y'all want it to be, then that's fine with me. And then years later, they ended up making me a trustee. And I was going out all over. I mean, I stayed out of prison most of the time. Going all in Baton Rouge, going all out in Jackson.
Clinton. Oh, you were at DCI this time?
Later on.
Okay.
Later on. So it opened up some doors. I was going to say
from David, wait, what were you doing about? But you were at DCI by this point.
So you're just out there just welding, just like random welding gigs?
I was doing whatever they needed me to do. Okay. I was sandbagging during the big flood in 2016. We were taking sandbags, like flatbed trailers full of sandbags, as high as we can stack them until they started falling off, and then just driving them over to Slaughter, Jackson, Clinton. That's where we ended up staying. Ended up going over there by St. Gabriel where the women's prison was flooding and, you know, unloading sandbags over there. And, you know, it was a losing battle because it just kept coming. Mm-hmm. It was crazy because right where they were putting the sandbags at, guys were all up to their chest in water, you know, trying to stop this water from going over the road. And as soon as they got out the water, they said, hey, come on, everybody, get out. Take a break. Get you some food. You guys have been going at it for hours. Take a break. So everybody's sitting on the side of the road, and next thing you know, all these alligator heads just started popping up all around right where they were standing in the water. They were actually trying to sandbag Alligator Bayou.
Jeez.
Right over there in St. Gary. It was insane. So, you know, whenever they needed something to go do, they'd come get me and you know, some of the other trustees. But I was, you know, glad to go and do whatever. You know, dig, you know, ditches for sewage lines burst. Or
you're like, absolutely.
Let's do it. I'm learning skills. You know, I'm learning how to work heavy equipment. I'm learning how to do plumbing work. I'm learning how to do construction.
Valuable skills that translate on the outside. Well, so what year were you paroled?
I was paroled in June of 2020.
And that's as a result of the Miller-Montgomery? Or?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So tell the – and I don't know if Andrew, when he was on here, if he shared, but you want to tell everybody what that law came to pass?
Yeah, the Miller case was for non-homicides, and the Montgomery – well, I take that back. It was the Roper case with non-homicides that were juvenile sentenced to life. Became parole eligible. Years later, the Miller case came out, and that was for homicides that were sentenced to life as juveniles. That gave them parole eligibility. And then most states say it's not retroactive, so it's going to be from this point forward. So then they had another case go before the Supreme Court, which was the Henry Montgomery case, which made it retroactive nationwide. That was a U.S. Supreme Court landmark case. And that gave us all an opportunity to go get resentenced in their own parishes, or in November of 2019, anybody that had 25 years or more served, they were automatically eligible for parole hearing. Not to be granted hearing, just to go before a board.
Did the parole project help you?
I went through the parole project. Yes, this is how they provided legal representation, an attorney, which would have cost my family $10,000 if we'd had to pay for an attorney.
Did you have Keith or who?
Keith Nordyke.
He's an animal, man.
We tried to hire him before I was eligible. I was fighting Jefferson Parish, and he says, "I'm not going to take your money because I don't think I can get it signed by the governor, you know, so, and I can't get you a hearing." He said, "But, you know, I'm not going to take the case." So we're thinking, okay, golly, I can't get him. We were willing to pay him $10,000 if they had to. You know, my folks would have sold everything they had to try and get me out of prison. And I just thank God they didn't have to, because then the parole project came into existence. Years later, after fighting them, I'm eligible for parole hearing. And Mr. Nordyke's working pro bono for parole project. He ends up taking my case, representing me, you know, scot-free. Didn't cost my family anything. Ended up going through the parole project program, which lasted about 2 weeks at the time. Now it's 4 weeks of classes and programming. It's like reentry, real intense reentry.
I had a...
what do they do, like throw iPhones at you during that and be like, scroll?
That's one of the toughest classes, actually, is technology. It's just learning how to use a cell phone, learning how to use a debit card. You figure you got guys 35.
You're 85. You went in 85.
End of 85, beginning of 86.
So I can't even imagine.
Internet, flat screen TVs. Cell phones, cars.
I'm telling you.
Freaking battery-powered cars.
I'd get there, they hand you a phone. I'm like, how do I even turn this on?
The hell is this?
How do I even use it? I don't know how to. I don't know what it does.
Did it look like an alien device to you whenever you first saw it, or did you understand that it was a
Did
phone?
You have a JP4 player? Were you familiar with that a little bit?
I was familiar with those. Okay, yeah, it was similar.
JP does allow you to have a little media pad, player. But it's not. A cell phone. I mean, it's not even comparable. They've got apps on it, like the music apps.
So touchscreen and stuff like that was...
Very limited.
Okay. But like it was like a concept.
I always wondered when the first guy to break through the JPEG wall was going to happen. And they haven't yet. Not that I know. Not yet.
So you were released in 2020?
June of 2020.
Okay, so you were in the middle of the pandemic. How was that on the inside? Like, how was it? Were people freaking out like they were on the outside here?
Yeah, it was. They shut down all the inmate programming, all the church services. They weren't letting anybody into the facility, fear that they would contaminate the entire prison. And so they limited a lot of... visitors into the facilities, and that was statewide. And so there was nothing going on. It was just sitting around the dorms most of the day. No work. You weren't going out anywhere. It was just, you know, day-to-day activities inside the dormitories, and that was pretty much limited. You got to go outside. Kept it limited to one or two dorms would go out together, and, you know, that's just kind of kept everybody separate. And so I get out, and everybody's like, "Oh no, you're missing out on everything because everything's closed down." And for me,
nothing was open anyway.
Not knowing what it was like before the pandemic, I come out and I just think everything's great. I'm wearing a mask, going everywhere I need to go. I'm riding a pink bicycle to get there because I had no transportation.
Was it a Schwinn?
It was a Huffy that probation and parole gave me once I got out, because they said, "Can you use anything?" I said, "Yeah, I can use a bike." So I get this pink mountain bike, and I'm thinking, damn, they're just messing with me now. I'm free, but I'm riding that pink bicycle like it was best bicycle.
How tall are you?
I'm about 6'1".
All 6'1". Like what? Heavy?
About 250.
250 on that. Debo.
My knees hitting the handlebars.
Where did you live at? Where were you living?
I'm living off of Brightside by LSU in Baton Rouge. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I'm in a transition house. I'm going to classes my first few weeks out with the parole project. They get me all my documentation, give me a bank account, got me on food stamps, trying to find employment. You know, I'm thinking I'm going to get a good job because I'm skilled, I'm educated, I got a college education while I was inside, and, you know, kind of vocational skills. None of my plans came to pass. Nobody wanted to hire me because I'm, you know, formerly incarcerated felon. And I was thinking, man, what am I going to do? Well, they teach you at parole project. First, you got to get, you know, the ABCs of employment. First, you got to get a job, any job. Just get some money in your pocket. Start saving money, you know, put it in your bank account. Then you look for your B job, which is a better job. And then eventually, after you can find one that could be your C job, would be your career. And so, you know, I was working temp jobs when I first got out, probably my first year, and working three or four different jobs. Worked at a mulch plant, worked at an animal shelter. I'm wrapping buses at the Capital Area Transit, you know, putting all that vinyl graphics on buses. Mm-hmm. But I was making good money, $200 a bus. And I couldn't beat that. And I was trying to work all the time. I wanted to go see my family on the weekends, but if I had a job came up that was, I was going to go make some money, I was going to go do that because I'm trying to get
rebuilding.
On my feet.
Yeah. Rebuilding.
My folks wanted me to come stay with them in Mandeville, and I thought, you know, let me stand on my own two feet for once in my life. You know, you took care of me my whole childhood when I lived with you in prison. You know, y'all supported me, came and visited me the whole time. I said, let me have this opportunity to just be a man. And, you know, I didn't care what kind of job it was. I said when I was in prison, I'd be happy being a garbage man because if I'd be free, then I'd be the happiest garbage man on the planet.
Right.
Because I'm out, you know, thinking of what I came from, being in prison with two life sentences, never going home, going to die there, and now I'm outside. Heck, whatever what kind of work you give me, I'm going to do it. I'm going to be happy. I'm going to be the best worker you got. I'm going to be there on time. I'm going to work extra if you let me. You know, I'm going to be the cleanest, neatest, most courteous employee that y'all have just because I had another shot.
Yeah.
And after about a year that I was out, ended up going to work with Andrew Hunley at Parole Project. He offered me a job as a reentry specialist. And I got to do things that's near and dear to my heart, you know, help people just like me who served 20, 30, 40, some of them even 50 years. And they get to come out and really just be like a mentor to them, hold their hands, you know, teach them how to live all over again because everything's different now.
Is Kelly's husband coming through the program?
He got out Sunday night.
I saw that.
Yeah, he got out Sunday night, and he's in the program right now.
Good. I was glad to see that. I know they've been waiting a long time.
Happy as can be, yeah.
I bet. Let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. What was your biggest challenge when you got released? What was the thing that you're like, wow, this is life?
You know, I had a lot of anxiety, a lot of fears, just thinking all my plans that I had didn't come to pass. What am I going to do? You know, what's most important to me? And I think the most important thing was not only was finding employment, a good job, but how can I work and still be able to go see my family? Because, you know, my mom and dad are elderly. My dad's 86 this year. My mom's 80. So, you know, I don't know how much longer they're going to be with me. So I just take advantage of every moment that I can with them. And, you know, that's probably the most precious thing to me, you know, is my family now. And thank God they're still together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, God worked it out where, you know, they didn't separate and ended up bringing them closer together. And they were doing prison ministry while I was in there. And now I'm doing prison ministry. I'm a volunteer at two prisons.
Which ones?
I go to DCI with the Catholic Volunteers, and I go to Elaine Hunt with a nonprofit out of Washington, D.C. It's called the Frederick Douglass Project, where we bring members of the public inside.
Like Kiana and all them came recently, right? Kiana and Pencil and all those, Ronald Marshall and all them
came. Yeah. Got to go through that. They take a tour, quick tour of the prison, and they get to speak with some of the residents there. And the whole point is for people on the outside and the public to see the humanity of the incarcerated individuals. You know, that they're just normal people that made bad choices, had to pay the circumstances, you know, and consequences of their actions, and trying to rehabilitate themselves and redeem themselves. You know, and they will be getting out one day.
I like that approach better than the one they had when I was at Rayburn. You know what they used to do that was so humiliating? I'd be on the yard, and for those, you know, the yard is the outside, and it's all separated by fences. So you got like,
it's this like the unit. Basketball court area?
Well, yeah, basketball workout. You got the dorms. So you got, you know, this yard, but it's fenced in. You got the yard next to the yard next. Well, and then they have a walk that's fenced too.
Just right through.
And they used to bring kids. I'm be out on the yard and I see these droves of kids walking down the walk and then looking at you like you there's a tiger. There's a hippopotamus. Ooh, big bad bear. You know, and it was just like, why are y'all parading these kids? This isn't scaring anybody. I don't know one kid who grew up and said, you know what, I avoided bullcrap because I went to jail one time and saw the big scary guys with their shirts off working out on the yard.
I never went.
I did.
You did?
I went in grade school. We toured the parish prison.
And he was like, I'm going back.
We laughed at him.
Right. Yeah,
they were in orange.
It's humiliating, man.
Yeah.
And especially for kids. It's like most of the guys that are in prison, a lot of us have kids. It's like, you see these young kids walking through, and you're like, you know, that could be my kid. And, like, this isn't the position that I want them to see me in.
When we went through, you know, we kind of poke fun at them because we knew we're never going to go to prison. You know, we got a good life. We're good kids, and this is not going to happen. But I ended up being in that same cell block where we made the tour, and I was in orange, and they still had schools. Same one, Jefferson Parish. And so here they come with the schools laughing at me inside the cell, damn. You know, in an orange jumpsuit. I'm like,
tables got turned.
Nah. Yeah. Well, Matt, man, I'm telling you, you got a freaking awesome story, man.
Thank you, brother.
I don't get emotional much, but when you're talking about the ladies, the daughters of the individuals, man, that was pretty impactful.
Absolutely.
And it's not too often you hear that type of stuff. So, man, commend you for staying strong all those years and being humble and, you know, taking your lick. And now you're home and you're successful and you're doing great things and you're giving back. And, you know, that's what rehabilitation is about. That's why we do this.
And Shout out those daughters for forgiving. That was a little Vicky caught me right here. Thank you, Vicky. Thank you, Debbie.
They're awesome.
Yeah. All right. Well, this concludes episode number one. We'll see you next time.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks,
season
guys.
Two.